The Guardian.
The NHS prepares for a possible coronavirus vaccine as the government scrambles to get anything ready for Brexit. I'm Heather Stewart, political editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
So, we've cleared one significant hurdle, but there are several more to go before we know the vaccine can be used.
This week, we finally saw a genuine ray of hope amid all the lockdown gloom. A COVID vaccine created by Pfizer and BioNTech showed it could be 90% effective, at least according to an interim analysis, but Boris Johnson's government presented an uncharacteristic note of caution when celebrating. Nevertheless, the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, told the NHS to get prepared for a mass rollout from next month, if needed. After a month of U-turns and stricter lockdowns, how can the government use this potential for hope to their advantage? Johnson will have welcomed the distraction, given the more we learn about Brexit plans, the more you have to wonder whether we'll ever get a deal. The government suffered an embarrassing defeat in the House of Lords, as peers voted to remove measures that seek to do away with parts of the Northern Ireland Protocol in the Brexit withdrawal agreement. And as we wait for Joe Biden's imminent arrival in the Oval Office, what does that mean for Brexit? And as people in England finish their first week in their second lockdown, they'll be watching as people in Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales have some restrictions lifted. Later on, I talked to my colleagues around the UK about the various approaches to COVID-19 by the devolved nations. Plus, Rajiv Sial speaks to the chair of the Education Select Committee, Robert Halfen. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, to discuss the week's developments in Westminster, I'm joined by The Guardian's political correspondent, Simon Murphy. Simon, thanks for joining me on the podcast. Let's start with some good news for a change. We saw this sort of ray of light this week, this report that Pfizer and BioNTech's vaccine was 90% effective. What's that going to mean in practical terms for the government? You watched Matt Hancock, didn't you, giving his statement yesterday, talking about how they're going to get ready to roll this out if it does prove that it works.
This is promising news. We in the UK are among the first to identify the promise shown by the vaccine, and we secured an order of 40 million doses. This puts us towards the front of the international pack.
Yeah, I was watching Matt Hancock give a statement. I mean, it's worth saying that this could really be, I suppose, obviously a watershed moment in fighting the pandemic. The government's whole strategy has been to, stated strategy has been to suppress the virus, but really they've been waiting for a vaccine to come along, a vaccine that works, and they've rolled the dice by sort of investing in a few competing different vaccines, but this is the one that seems to be coming through first. And I suppose you could imagine that a few officials in Number 10 might have been quietly celebrating when they heard the news on Monday, although it's worth stressing that Matt Hancock has said that we're not there yet, and that this vaccine needs to be cleared, as safe before it can be rolled out. But crucially, he has readied the NHS with the support of the armed services to deliver this vaccine, to roll it out from the 1st of December. But more likely, I think, if things do go as everyone hopes they will, we'll see, Matt Hancock says, a mass rollout in the first part of next year.
And they're also pressing ahead, aren't they, with mass testing, which is the other bit of their sort of two-pronged strategy, and that they've put quite a lot of weight on this Operation Moonshot idea that lots of us could be having quite regular tests. What's been happening on that front this week? We've heard a bit more about it, haven't we?
We have, yes. It's, it's a two-pronged approach, isn't it, from the government? Well, maybe more prongs than that, but certainly waiting for a vaccine. But the other part is introducing mass testing, should I say, so that society can sort of get back to normality in terms of people functioning every day. Because obviously, if they can get a test and it says that they haven't got the disease, it gives them some confidence that they can go about their normal lives. So we've seen a trial in Liverpool recently of mass testing beyond just those people who have symptoms. And what we've heard this week is that this kind of testing regime, as it were, is going to be rolled out to, I think, 67 more areas.
One hope is, isn't it, that they can cut the self-isolation period. There's been a lot of worry about that aspect of it, hasn't there, that people aren't self-isolating enough. And our colleagues, Sev Carell and Sarah Bosley, had a story this week, didn't they, about a bit of a row in Number 10 about whether it could be cut, potentially right down, to a week or less, that isolation period in a bid to try and persuade more people to obey the rules.
Absolutely right. And look, the key issue here is that I think the stats show that only 11% of people are abiding fully by the 2-week isolation rule. So there's no point in having a rule if people don't follow it. And clearly the data show that people aren't doing that at the moment. So I think it's fair to say there's a debate raging inside Number 10 and across government about what to do next. And obviously, as you pointed out, our talented colleagues have broken the story that we are expected to have that 2-week period cut to 10 days. But at the kind of centre of this row is a disagreement, shall we say, we understand between the Chief Medical Officer, Professor Chris Whitty, and Dominic Cummings, who is obviously Boris Johnson's most senior aide, who's been pushing for this change. So, you know, there'll be arguments on both sides, but we'll watch that one very closely.
Yeah, and another sort of effort to try and have something positive to say to people and something point to a more of a normality, I suppose. They're very keen. Boris Johnson has been very keen, hasn't he, to say that Christmas might look a bit more normal than life does at the moment. Is that realistic? Do you think that we're supposed to be talking to the devolved authorities about that, aren't we?
Well, I mean, that's probably a $1 million question. I remember, if I cast my mind back to the summer, covering Boris Johnson's speech at Downing Street, in which he said,
"It is my strong and sincere hope that we will be able to review the outstanding restrictions and allow a more significant return to normality from November at the earliest, possibly in time for Christmas."
That was obviously some time ago. And since then, we've had a kind of restrictive measures introduced and we're now in the midst of this month-long lockdown. So my honest answer would be it's very difficult to say what we're going to see. But, you know, it's not surprising to hear politicians say that they hope for that to happen.
Yeah, I think he's desperate to give us some good news, isn't he? The other running theme this week, Simon, to some extent, has been the sort of whiff of cronyism around this government that we're starting to hear more and more about, whether it's the allocation of contracts to deal with the pandemic to sort of friends or friends of friends or partners of friends or former business contacts or whatever. There's been a focus this week, hasn't there, on Kate Bingham, who's the chair of the vaccines task force. She seems to have hired in some very expensive PRs, doesn't she, at considerable cost to taxpayers' money, and they would argue absolutely all above board, and it's a fund that looks for medicine, so what's wrong with that? But it's becoming a bit of a sort of running issue, this, isn't it?
Yeah, there's been a lot of pressure on the government over that issue. I suppose another story worth pointing out is the Good Law Project has launched legal action over £4 billion worth of COVID-related contracts that have been awarded to private companies by the government. So there are issues here, I think, around transparency. But, you know, supporters of the government, defenders of the government would say that they've had to do an awful lot in a very short space of time. And broadly, they're trying to do their best. Clearly, others would say that they're not getting anything right by any long shot. So, you know, there's kind of tensions there on both sides. But I think you're right to say that you know, the government's been under mounting pressure over the vaccine SAR issue for sure. The kind of news that emerged in recent days was that she is actually due to stand down. Now, whether or not that's been precipitated by this row, we don't know. But, you know, it certainly was the news that emerged this week.
Simon, I'm just going to jump to our Brexit correspondent, Lisa O'Carroll, who's just joined us. Lisa, another busy week in Brexit land and another rebuke of the government's internal market bill.
Absolutely. Overwhelming defeat inflicted on the government in the House of Lords, as expected, on Monday night. But it was absolutely extraordinary to sit through the debate here. Lord Judge, the former Chief Justice of England and Wales, just forensically go through each clause in Part 5. This is the Brexit clauses in the internal market, and eviscerate them. One in particular, he pointed out, it has been pointed out before, but he is, you know, one of the most eminent lawyers in the land, or has been, said it was just extraordinary for a parliament to seek executive powers which would not be challengeable in any court whatsoever. This is very, very serious stuff. And, you know, the government's response immediately after the defeat of the two amendments removing those clauses was defiant. We're going to reinsert them.
Lisa, presumably the government's intention then is when this bill comes back to the Commons, they'll reinsert these bits. And then you set up an almighty row, don't you, between the Commons and the Lords, potentially?
This is what they've said. I suppose there are two things. One is the timetable for the return to the House of Commons. It was due to come back before the 23rd of November, so not so far away. But it looks like now it won't come back till December. So it looks like they're trying to, it's, you know, there's a strategic thing going on here, parallel talks in the joint committee between the UK and the EU to try and wave away many of the checks, particularly on food, between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And if they can find a way of finessing that and minimising or even removing some of those checks that are causing the political offence and the economic offence in the supply chain in Northern Ireland, then there won't be a need for the internal market bill. But then the government, I think one of the issues is the government has never been open about that. We had Dominic Raab on Sunday morning on Andrew Marr and on Sky saying this is a safety net. And as Lord Judge said, this just trivialises these clauses. So it goes back to the transparency and what is the government up to? These are the questions I think have kind of marked the Johnson stewardship so far.
And do you think they could quietly drop it if they get a Brexit deal, as you know, we'll find out very shortly, won't we? Do you think they could quietly shelve these clauses, even though at the moment they're being very sort of defiant about it?
I think they could, because if you look at how they were introduced, you know, by stealth overnight, very, very suddenly. And I think if a deal has been struck, there will be such relief around the country among businesses. There'll be an awful lot of commentary that will, I think, mean that those bills just are kind of a footnote. If there's no deal, the coverage will be even greater. We'll be back in a kind of a double crisis of COVID and no deal Brexit looming at the same time. And I think these internal market bill, well, who knows whether they'll be dropped in that scenario, but I think they can be.
And Michel Barnier, who was leading the Brexit talks from the EU side, was back in London this week, wasn't he, with his EU COVID mask on. What are the prospects now, do we feel, Lisa? We're really running out of time here, aren't we?
It's difficult to tell. You get one sort of narrative from the EU and you get another from the UK side, which I have to say, again, has been less than transparent about its position. I'm hearing good things from the EU side, that they are converging around a deal on fishing involving a transition period on fishing with a front-loaded in favour of the UK quota system in the first couple of years, perhaps 5 years. On the state aid, there seemed to be significant headway on that, but both sides have said there are still significant gaps. I'm still of the view that there will be a deal, but there are worrying things. You know, let's not forget all the other things that have to follow that may not have the time to be agreed on. For instance, aviation, haulage, policing, foreign policy, security. Well, we know foreign policy isn't there at all, but it will raise its ugly head again. So even if we get a deal, we're not there. We'll be talking Brexit for years, Heather.
And we saw a big change in the sort of big shift in the tectonic plates, didn't we, of global politics this week with a Biden presidency forthcoming. Does that make a difference? There was some speculation, wasn't there, in Brussels, certainly, that Johnson was waiting to see who won that election before deciding which way to go on an EU deal.
Yeah, I think the EU definitely saw political capital and leverage in a Biden victory. You can see straight away that Biden's approach to Europe is completely different. He had calls with four leaders yesterday. I think speculation that the UK and US's special relationship would somehow be compromised because of Biden's kind of hostility to Brexit and special interest because of his Irish ancestry, partly in Northern Ireland. I think that was misplaced. His main interests, I think, will be to, and he said it himself, to reimagine, reinvigorate the relationship with the EU, which was badly damaged by Donald Trump. Remember, we had trade wars with Germany, we had phony wars with Scotland, with tariffs on whiskey. On Ireland, he spoke about the Good Friday relationship, as well as COVID, economic recovery. He has also, in his calls with the UK, Germany and France, made a big point about NATO, which we know Donald Trump had very strong views on in relation to funding. You know, what we're looking at is a period of a rebuild and renewal of the transatlantic relationship. Brexit will be part of that, but it won't be the priority in America.
Simon, to bring you back in here, Boris Johnson finally got his call with Joe Biden yesterday afternoon, and he wasn't at the back of the line, as it were. Downing Street would have been quite relieved about that, won't they? There's always a lot of speculation in these sort of transitional moments about what the relationships are going to be like.
Yeah, it's interesting there that Lisa said, obviously, there'll be hope that this is a kind of renewal of that special relationship. But it's fair to say things probably didn't get off to the best start because it emerged this week that when Downing Street, I think this was before Boris Johnson's call with Joe Biden, sent out a congratulatory tweet, it actually appeared that they'd already written one congratulating Trump, preparing for his victory. And the message was hidden effectively underneath this first message. And when it was exposed, Downing Street had to come clean and actually admit that they had in fact written the two messages, prepared them both for both scenarios. So perhaps it's fair to say that they weren't entirely confident about the result themselves.
It's a bit like Boris Johnson writing his two columns in the run-up to Brexit, isn't it? How on earth does something like that happen? Number 10 usually absolutely prides itself, doesn't it, on its slick communications, in particularly slick digital communications.
Yeah, I mean, look, your guess is as good as mine, but in the words of the government, it was a technical error. But I think, you know, it's important to say there is a tension there that exists between Boris Johnson and Joe Biden. Joe Biden's never met Boris Johnson, I think is what we've been told. So that the two men have never actually met in person. But also there's a tension that exists there from when Barack Obama was president. Boris Johnson infamously described him in an article as part Kenyan. And for that reason, said he had some kind of anti-British sentiment. That was over a row over Winston Churchill's bust in the Oval Office. But he took a lot of criticism for that comment. And I think it's fair to say it's not been forgotten by those who are close to Obama.
And Lisa, it's a very big year coming up for the sort of Johnson premiership next year, in a sense, because Britain is chair of the G7, isn't it? And also is chairing this COP26 summit. And I guess with some light at the end of the tunnel, potentially, on coronavirus, they will be thinking in number 10 about you know, a sort of fresh start for 2021, I'm sure.
Absolutely. I believe Joe Biden will be doing exactly the same. Remember, he is famed for his ability to work a bipartisan politics, to reach across the aisle. So I think the COP26 conference will be key. I imagine Biden will make a tour of Europe before that, however. There was speculation that he might go to Brussels first, and that's not so much to do with Brexit, but that is the NATO headquarters. And he would definitely take a trip to the UK, Ireland, France and Germany.
Lisa O'Carroll and Simon Murphy, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you.
After the break, I speak to colleagues about how the second wave is being tackled around the UK, and Rajiv Syal speaks to Robert Halfen, the chair of the Education Select Committee. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. Now, last week, England entered its second national lockdown in an effort to bring the number of coronavirus cases and deaths way down. But as we've got used to in the UK, Downing Street was slower than the devolved governments of Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland to impose such draconian measures. As we speak, the Northern Ireland executive is trying to negotiate a way out of a four-week shutdown, which is due to end on Friday. On Monday, people living in Wales emerged from a 17-day national firebreak lockdown, where most businesses, excluding essential shops, were forced to close. And yesterday, Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon announced that no local authority in Scotland would be put into the highest tier of COVID restrictions after leaving their version of a lockdown. So how have the various approaches helped or hindered their attempts to beat coronavirus? And are the growing differences between how Westminster and those in Stormont, Holyrood and Cardiff deal with things giving voters bigger ideas about devolution or independence? Well, to discuss all of that, I spoke to The Guardian's Ireland correspondent Rory Carroll, Scotland correspondent Libby Brooks and Stephen Morris, who covers Wales for us. Libby, Rory, Stephen, lovely to gather you all, not quite together, but to be able to hear you all at least. Libby, without going into any specifics just yet, it's been really striking, hasn't it, how the different devolved governments have approached this second wave and how we've been able to see those differences.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I was actually really struck a couple of weekends ago when I was writing an update on where the devolved nations had got to just as England announced its lockdown. So particularly seeing just how far back Scotland had been instituting much more stringent restrictions on household meetings, for example, either in terms of visits to one another's homes or in restaurants and cafes. And then, you know, of course, in Wales and across the water too, you know, particularly Scotland and Wales introducing a much stricter rule of six, for example, at the start of September, as the warnings grew around the pandemic spreading again.
And Stephen, it's been noticeable how little communication there seems to have been, isn't it, between the four leaders? I mean, not for lack of complaining on the part of Nicola Sturgeon and Mark Drakeford.
That's right. I don't think it's the four leaders' fault. I think perhaps it's the fault of Downing Street. Certainly from the Welsh perspective, they're very keen to keep on talking to Boris Johnson and the rest of his government. but they don't have that much engagement all the time. I think it's got better in the last week or so. There seems to have been an improved engagement there. They're talking about Christmas together at the moment. So there are signs that it's improved, but I know Mark Drakeford's frustrated when Boris Johnson tends to be very chipper about the future, saying it's going to be over in 12 weeks or over by Christmas or over by the spring. That's not his way. He's very cautious in his approach. And I think there's a real clash of personalities there, as well as a clash of politics.
I think that's right. Politics, personalities and style. Rory, each country has their own chief scientific officer and chief medical officer, don't they? When did the Assembly in Northern Ireland get alerted to the potential for a second wave? And then how quickly did they act?
I think around September, the numbers started creeping up. And they didn't, with hindsight, one can see they didn't respond quickly enough. I think they've been lulled into a bit of complacency by the fact that Northern Ireland had one of the lowest rates in the UK during spring and early summer. But then that suddenly changed horribly through September and October, when it zoomed up to having the worst rates, especially in Derry and the Strabane area. They had rates far worse than Liverpool and other parts of Northern England. And there's still a bit of a mystery as to what happened and how that happened. But the, I suppose the good news here is that since restrictions were imposed again on the 16th of October, they have worked. You know, the famous R number has now dropped to about 0.7. And so Northern Ireland is now, you know, dropping and has a much more better rate within the UK. But it was a shock to the whole system here, just how fast things could get out of control.
Interestingly, Rory, Northern Ireland's circuit breaker, if that's what we call it, this idea of a short-term shutdown that Boris Johnson initially thought was a terrible idea and then, of course, as we know, had to embrace. Northern Ireland's version of it, Arlene Foster announced the closure of schools, didn't she, as well as other kinds of businesses. Why did she do that, do you think? And does that seem to have been part of why it's worked?
Well, it's again, the concern is that they're not quite sure why things got out of control so fast in the first place. And now they're not sure just how sustainable the fact that numbers have fallen. Sinn Féin, for instance, is lobbying for restrictions to be extended, whilst elements in the DUP, who are especially representing the business community, are very keen for the hospitality sector to be allowed to start functioning again. So you have, as ever, Northern Ireland's a strong kind of political tinge to everything. Plus, you have the fact that the border here in the south of Ireland, there is still on maximum restrictions until the end of the month. And so there's pressure on Northern Ireland to try to mirror the restrictions in the Republic, because otherwise you'll get this kind of spillover along the border. And we're still waiting since Monday for a decision from the Stormont Executive as to whether restrictions will be extended on Friday or whether they are will be lifted as currently planned.
And Stephen, presumably there's a bit of that issue in Wales too, right? At the Wales-England border, where Wales is coming out, isn't it, as almost as England went in. Has that been a problem?
It remains to be seen what sort of a problem it's going to be. There's certainly concerns about it. Last week, the First Minister was talking about this being the hardest border between England and Wales we've had for centuries, he said. Certainly, I went to Wrexham at the very end of last week, and in Chepstow this week, border towns, people are wondering, are loads of people going to come from England to Wales to do their shopping? Shops are closed in England largely, but not in Wales. Will they come for a night out, to go to the pub, for a restaurant meal? So there's certainly concern that people are going to be crossing the border from England to Wales to carry on with their lives, as actually they did during the last phase of this, when Wales was locked down but England was open. Certainly people were travelling from Wales to England to have a drink or a night out.
And we had these anomalies too, didn't we, about sort of non-essential and essential shops. It's always difficult to know where to draw the line with these things, isn't it? But we had these sort of pictures of sort of taped off aisles in some shops and so on. Was that problematic, or was that just a sort of smattering of news stories? Did it generally work well?
I think it was problematic for the Welsh Government to begin with. It didn't look good. They had a real backlash against them for a few days after they said supermarkets can stay open, but you can't buy non-essential items. I think that died down after a few days. And the Welsh Government said, yeah, we think we may have got that wrong a little bit. And next time, if there is a next time, we'll do it a different way.
We should talk about whether these restrictions seem to be working. Rory, your suggestion was in Northern Ireland so far, so good. It looks as if it is having an impact.
Yes, and also likewise in the south of Ireland, where the lockdown here has also brought numbers way, way down. It's now got the among the lowest 14-day incidence rate in all of Europe. So there's a sense here that they are working. And the question is, for how long do you persist? And in the south, the decision has been taken to continue right up until December the 1st. Whereas Northern Ireland, it seems that they're going to, either if not this week, maybe the following week, will ease restrictions and do so at a time when the rates in Northern Ireland are substantially still higher than in the south of Ireland. So it's obviously, this is more art than science, or more politics than science, as to when do you take the foot off the pedal.
And Stephen, is it too soon to say whether the Welsh restrictions have had an impact?
Well, Wales came out of its fire break on Monday. And up until then, the government had been saying it's going to be a couple of weeks before we know. But then suddenly yesterday, they were sounding a little bit more positive. They were saying tentative, early positive signs that the figures are going down across Wales and in certain hotspot areas like the South Wales valleys in particular. So they were being a bit more upbeat, which, as I alluded to earlier, is not really like them. They do tend to be very cautious, and they were being a bit more optimistic. But whether that's to try and buoy people along a bit, to give people hope, there might be an element of that in it too.
Yeah, I mean, likewise, we've been having very optimistic noises from Nicola Sturgeon, but I think the thing that she has been very clear about is that optimism does not equal restrictions easing up. And as we're speaking today, I'm just waiting for her to do her first weekly review of the new sort of five-tier levels that we've got in Scotland. She was very clear last week that she wasn't going to be diverted from the tier system by the English lockdown. She's said that infection rates are levelling out, but they're not yet coming down. And as far as she's concerned, that doesn't make her confident that the tier levels that we've got at the moment are likely to change significantly, which means that sort of certainly for most of central Scotland and a few sort of other city areas, they will be sort of continue to be at tier three, which is sort of just off full lockdown, but with sort of a few hospitality places allowed open, but the alcohol ban continuing and sort of complete meeting bans as well.
Remains to be seen what we'll see imposed in England, of course, once this lockdown period comes to an end. We should talk about the financial or economic aspects of this, shouldn't we? Because, you know, we had this extraordinary statement from the Chancellor last week. Suddenly, once England had decided it was time to go, or once Boris Johnson had decided it was time for England to go into a lockdown, all of a sudden this furlough scheme, which he'd been telling us had to come to an end at the end of October. Gosh, you know, suddenly it's been extended right through to March, right across the UK. I mean, that was a real point of contention, Libby, wasn't it, for the Scottish government, who felt that businesses that they were asking to close for the right reasons were not being given the support they needed.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, we were talking about lack of communication earlier, and this was an absolute case in point in that, you know, this announcement was made over the weekend. Both the Scottish and the Welsh governments were sort of left completely in the dark as to whether the furlough scheme was going to apply to them in future as well. And I mean, my understanding of it is that it really was one of those situations where it was just about Westminster not being mindful of the impact that a decision made about England was going to have on the devolved nations, and so they sort of then ended up in a sort of terrible scuddle going back and forth with Nicola Sturgeon and Drakeford over the week, and Douglas Ross, the Scottish Conservative leader, then, you know, sort of valiantly standing up for Scotland in the House of Commons and making Boris Johnson commit to this. But then you had the Treasury, I think, again, sort of very anxious about the fact that they were getting painted into a corner and might be having to write a blank cheque for the devolved nation. So it really was it was a right old mess, but it worked out in the end.
And Rory, for Northern Ireland, this comes at a time when businesses are having to try and prepare themselves for Brexit, of course, doesn't it? Or rather for the end of the post-Brexit transition period, which is particularly bites on the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic. This is just a sort of complicating factor, presumably, isn't it? The sort of cross-cutting restrictions that businesses are also facing.
Yes, businesses are saying, give us a break. You know, how are we expected to cope? How are we expected to survive, protect jobs under these circumstances? and the hospitality sector, for example, has been protesting very strongly. This week, we get a suggestion that restrictions may be, they may be allowed to reopen, but not serve alcohol. And they are saying that's not going to work. You know, they've been kind of quite strong in pushing back in a way that we didn't see during the first lockdown. Because, and there's this a febrile sense among the business community more widely in the region that, you know, we're in uncharted territory now, and because in terms of employment and what may happen in January. So yeah, a lot of nervousness. And that's why I think the DUP is now beginning to representing that business community saying, let's end this lockdown this week.
Yeah, the sort of economic arguments are starting to play more and more strongly as time goes on, I think, aren't they? Everywhere. I should ask you all, as we've talked about these very different ways of managing the pandemic in the different devolved nations, I wonder how much that sense as, that things have been managed differently has added to the case for independence, Libby, presumably in Scotland, quite considerably, one would think.
Yes, I mean, you just need to look at the polling numbers to see that we've had the first sort of consistent majority in support of independence ever since polling began on this subject. And it's really hard to sort of decouple that from the fact that you have, as I said before, this sort of incredible amount of public trust in the way that Nicola Sturgeon has handled the pandemic. I guess my question would be, how lasting is that commitment to independence, you know, sort of post-pandemic, when Nicola Sturgeon is not on screen every day? Will that change how people feel about independence in the long run? It's impossible to know at the moment.
And Stephen, we've obviously been seeing a lot of Mark Drakeford, and as you say, getting a sense of how he manages things differently from Westminster and what powers he does and doesn't have. Is any of that starting to, are we starting to hear more about, you know, perhaps we'd like a more generous devolution settlement, or does it just sort of stoke general anti-English irritation?
We're certainly hearing more from people who are, we've got this word indicurious. I don't know whether that is used in Scotland and in Ireland as well, but many more people thinking about independence and wondering whether it's a good idea or not for Wales. But Mark Drakeford is a unionist. He believes Wales is better within the union, and he says that whenever he can. He said it last week over the furlough system, that it's basically a good job we're in the union because we will get the furlough system. He says that what this pandemic has shown is that Wales does have independent powers now and is using them. Wales is acting in a different way to the UK government, to England, and that's working as far as he's concerned.
Interesting. So it's a kind of vindication of the powers that he does have, rather than showing the need for more. And Rory, finally, in Northern Ireland, it feels a little bit as if the constitutional settlement is in play more than it has been for some time, perhaps because of Brexit. Potentially, is the management of the pandemic been another factor there, or in a way has it shown how the system, existing system, works? Do you think
it's kind of going both ways at the same time? Sinn Féin is arguing the case that this shows the need and the logic of having an all Ireland entities and unity, basically saying, look, you know, we're an island, it makes sense to join up government. And here in a pandemic, we're just showing how that would be such a good idea. And they've been arguing strongly for that. However, the daily briefings or weekly briefings here, where you see the Sinn Féin Deputy First Minister, Michelle O'Neill, standing alongside the DUP First Minister, Arlene Foster, and you see the two of them, who pre-pandemic had a pretty terrible relationship, now cooperating, being civil to each other, and actually building a kind of a sisterhood of cooperation. That, in a sense, is showing that, or giving a sense that Northern Ireland as an entity can work, and so that it doesn't actually necessarily need unity with the South for Northern Ireland to function. And certainly that's a message that the DUP hopes will be the one of the legacies of the pandemic.
Really interesting. Listen, thank you all so much. It's been really great conversation. Thank you, Libby, Rory and Stephen.
Thank you, Heather.
Thank you.
Now, to finish us off this week, I'll turn over to my colleague Rajiv Sayal, who for the last month has been chatting to chairs of some of the parliamentary select committees. For the final conversation of this mini-series, Rajiv spoke to Robert Halfen, the chair of the Education Select Committee. Robert's been arguing for many years that the Conservative Party needs to plug into the concerns of ordinary working families and fight for social justice if it is truly to shed its image of looking after the interests of the undeserving wealthy. And so you might have expected him to be in lockstep with Boris Johnson's government after its breakthrough success at the last election in a wave of former Labour strongholds. Instead, Halfon has found himself in recent weeks at the forefront of Tory criticisms of the Johnson-led government. He was one of a handful of Conservative MPs who rebelled against the government over free school meals.
Welcome, Robert Halfon.
Hello there. Good to be on.
We've seen a remarkable change of heart this weekend. The second so-called U-turn on free school meals, with Johnson pledging a package, includes a £170 million COVID winter grant scheme to support vulnerable families in England, an extension of the holiday activities and food programme to the Easter, summer and Christmas breaks next year. Should Boris Johnson just admit defeat and give in to Rashford's demands to expand free school meals to all under 16s where a parent or guardian is in receipt of universal credit or equivalent benefits?
Well, I think it's important to acknowledge that the government has just made an incredibly important step forward. And whilst I voted against the Prime Minister for the first time in this Parliament, I felt that I had to do it because I see it in my own constituency of Harlow, with families really struggling with the cost of living, with people being made jobless, with endemic child poverty. And I felt that food hunger is something that we really need to grapple with. And to be fair to the government, the policies announced are big ones. There's money for the health vouchers. They're going to be increased. So I'm happy to campaign when I think the government have got it wrong. But I think it's also, when they make an important step forward, I think it's also important to welcome that.
Won't the party be under pressure to make further concessions as soon as Marcus Rashford restarts the campaign with the opposition's support?
I think the next argument will be about how that, whatever extra measures there are, how that the best way of spending that money. And one of those that's proposed is that everyone on universal credit should get it. I'm not yet convinced that's the right answer, because it may be that some families who get universal credit but are working will get it. It may be that the money could be spent on rolling out breakfast clubs to disadvantaged children. And I think that it may be worth spending the money on family hubs, which are based on Sure Start centres, but actually have a lot more going on inside them, with doctors on the premises, with education, with mentors, with counselling, with mental health support. Everything I've learned as Education Committee Chair is that early intervention is perhaps the most important investment you can make, because if we invest money in early intervention, we won't have these poverty issues to begin with.
Yes, you were one of many Conservative MPs who questioned a couple of weeks ago whether the government could grapple with social problems as a result of COVID, such as millions of kids not learning and the fact that 32% of families have had a drop in income. There have been several policy reversals this year over schools, such as the decision on face coverings being worn, the announcement that A-levels and GCSE grades will be based on teacher assessments, and the decision to drop the government's ambition to ensure that all primary age children in England would have at least 4 weeks in school before the summer. Is there a possibility that parents, teachers and pupils could lose faith in the government's ability to make policy decisions?
Well, I think that we're in a national emergency, and I think the government is walking a tightrope between trying to protect the economy and protect our nation's health. Not a very easy tightrope, and in many cases from today to day they're firefighting. So I do recognise that it is difficult for the government, because all the energies of the government are focused on trying to avoid death on the one side and avoiding destitution on the other. And the way I look at people go talk about U-turns is I don't care if there are U-turns. I just see them as right turns. So if the government have changed because of a realisation that the original decision has not been the right one, well, I think we should welcome that, because what would you prefer? A government that just ploughs on regardless and doesn't listen to both public opinion and policy, recognise that the policy is right. So I just regard these things not as a U-turn, but as a right turn.
I just wanted to relay a story from Chris Dyson, who's the head teacher at Parkland School in Leeds, who told the BBC that his school had been allocated 61 laptops as part of the laptop scheme to provide technology for the use of under privileged children. When he received an email from Department of Education in October saying it secured an extra 100,000 laptops, was updating its allocation process, he hoped that number would increase. But he said, I actually need 168. So I logged on, expecting to hopefully see my 61 had gone up, and it destroyed me. It flattened me when I saw it's actually been cut to 13. You have previously questioned ministers over why children on the pupil premium were not covered by this laptop scheme. So were you disappointed by DfE letters sent to Northern schools saying the numbers in some schools have been cut by 80%?
Yes, because I don't understand why, rather than having a massive, complicated national procurement laptop scheme where all the laptops are bought centrally, and why one couldn't have just given, or the government couldn't have just given schools vouchers to go down to the local Currys or Argos, or order them online and buy Chromebooks that cost 200 quid. I'm not a salesman for Google, just so you know, but when I asked the minister about this, he said it's impossible because that the amount of laptops that need to be ordered, you know, hundreds of thousands, which makes it impossible that the companies wouldn't have enough. But when I speak to the teachers, I ask them, could you just have gone down to your local Currys and done it with vouchers? That would have been a much better solution to make sure the laptops arrived, that they were amenable to what the actual teachers needed. They could identify the pupils themselves, how many. So that's the way I would have proceeded. But governments always tend to go for these big procurement schemes because I'm guessing that they say, well, they offer value for money and can upscale. But I wouldn't have done it this way. Just the one thing, I have been told by the Department of Education that those teachers that didn't get the correct allocation or that feel that their allocation is enough can approach the DfE directly to get Department of Education to get some more.
Right. OK. So they can go back to the department and get those.
That's what I've been told. There is a helpline that they can apply for more if they need them.
Right, OK. And you put this to the minister, have you?
Well, we raised it in committee with the minister when he came to us last week. And he, in essence, used the argument that it was because of the scale of the amount of computers that were needed. If you did it, if you just gave the money to the teachers directly, there wouldn't be enough computers for people to buy. But whatever teacher I've asked, of whatever political persuasion, they seem to think that it would have been much better for them just to literally have done it themselves.
On another huge education issue, which I'm sure many teachers officials are grappling with, where do you stand on GCSEs and A-level exams? Should they go ahead next year?
Well, I think that they should go ahead, ideally, with a delay. It may be that if more and more schools are sent, children are sent home, or bubbles are sent home, or year groups are sent home, that the government need to look at it. But if it is teacher assessed grade, I would have an independent human, not an algorithm, human assessor, perhaps an Ofsted, retired Ofsted inspector or retired teachers sort of acting as independent assessors of those individual teacher grades that they gave their pupils. But my preference is that the exams take place.
I suppose what many people are looking for is clarity. Is there a specific date by which you think the department should tell pupils and teachers?
I think it needs to be pretty soon. I asked the department way back in September that there would be proper nationwide assessments going on in every school in the country, linked to the DfE and schools, to find out how much learning has been lost and how much catch up is needed. Then to make a decision on the exams based on that. The government say that assessment is being done, but you know, time is pressing. We're in lockdowns. I think an announcement needs to be made pretty soon.
Will you be pushing to make sure students around the country, including those students who saw fences go up outside their dorm halls in Manchester, will be able to go home at the holidays if they want to?
Yes, I think it's absolutely, I've said this publicly, the idea that students would not spend their Christmas with their families or their holiday season with their families is unthinkable.
we've seen reports that this pandemic will have a long-term negative effect on the education that children going to school now will end up getting. So what package of measures would you like to see the government introduce to offset this probable damage?
I think the damage is enormous. We know that for one reason or another, despite the remarkable efforts of individual teachers, individual schools, the support staff, we know that around 2.3 million children did no learning or hardly any learning at all during the lockdown. I think it was a Department of Education director themselves said the attainment gap could widen between advantaged and disadvantaged students by as much as 75%. It's why I campaign from literally from Easter onwards for a catch-up fund in which schools could and teachers and support staff could be supported by retired teachers, volunteers. The catch-up fund will help. There needs to be a lot of work to make sure it's rolled out properly. I think we are going to need reform of the pupil premium. I welcome the pupil premium. It's 2.5 billion a year. The catch-up fund is a billion a year. So there's 3.5 billion potentially to help disadvantaged pupils. And we've just got to make sure that money is spent wisely. I think all the effort, not all the effort, but a significant amount of effort from the government should be to lessen the attainment gap between disadvantaged pupils and their better off peers.
Robert Halfon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's all from us this week. Make sure to listen into Tuesday's episode of our sister podcast Today in Focus, where my colleague and co-host Jessica Elgott explains the fallout from the publication of the EHRC's investigation into anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. And the US election might be over, but the talking points to come from Donald Trump's dramatic failure to win a second term continue to grow. So make sure to listen to Jonathan Friedland and Richard Wolff sift through the global response to the upcoming Trump exit. Search for that in the usual Politics Weekly feed on Friday morning. But for now, I want to thank our guests, Rajiv Sial, Simon Murphy, Lisa O'Carroll, Libby Brooks, Stephen Morris, Rory Carroll, and of course, Robert Halfon. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Heather Stewart. Please look after yourselves and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.